Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, Alexis Wiley, the chief strategist for Moment Strategies, talks about working as the chief of staff for Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan and her perceptions on the future of Highland Park. State Rep Sarah Leitner is asked what legislative Republicans want out of this budget process after none of them have supported a single subcommittee spending plan from the Democrats at this point in the process. And State Rep Noah Arbit talks about expanding the statute of limitations on sexual assault cases, expanded penalties on hate crimes, and more. MERS editor Kyle Malin is with publisher John Rurink and Samantha Schreiber.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. The future of Highland Park, continuing as its own municipality, has to be called into question, according to the Citizens Research Council, who wrote a blog post this past week looking into the troubled city that is within the borders, actually, of the city of Detroit, now that the courts have ruled that it owes $24 million for unpaid water and sewer use. Join us to start off the podcast to talk about that is Alexis Wiley. She was the chief of staff for Mayor Mike Duggan and is now the CEO and chief strategist for Moment Strategies. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me.
So is there a future for Highland Park?
I think that's such a tough question because it's also, you know, while we look at everything from a financial perspective, when it comes to people's cities and communities, there's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of attachment to it, right? But I think that one thing that we have to be cognizant of is, you know, cities have to and communities have to really deliver on the basics for people, right? They want to make sure that when they're paying their water bill, that the money is actually going to pay the water bill, right? They want to make sure that the money they're spending in taxes and all of those things are actually delivering on services, right? And I think if you look at what's happening in Highland Park, I would say that if you ask some people who live there, there might be some questions about whether they're getting the value that they feel like they're investing in their community. And I also think long-term, it makes sense to be asking questions about really what's the economic path? What are the new companies that might be coming to Highland Park? Is there an opportunity for new housing? How are this, you know, when it comes to education, what's the path, what's the future there? People want to live places where they feel like they can see a future for themselves and their families. And if that future does not, if it doesn't appear to be a future, then I think there need to be some real questions about long-term viability of such a small community. That would be kind of my thought on that. But it's a complicated question that I think the community of Highland Park needs to be deeply engaged in every step.
The Citizens Research Council noted that Highland Park has lost so many people and has so much of its tax base has gone away that it is arguably unsustainable. But then the question becomes then, you know, even if the state comes in and helps out and pays most of the $24 million it owes on the water bill, let's just say they can get rid of most of that, if not all of that. What is the industry? How do they pay for stuff going forward? And who would want them? Would the city of Detroit want them? Would Hamtramck want them? What do you think to that?
Well, you know, I am now somebody who's in the same position as you, looking out from the outside, not in a position to make decisions around any of this. But I think you're asking the right question, right? I mean, once the bill is paid, if there's no money following after that in terms of their own path to generate revenue as a community, what is the future? Right. And the question is, who would want them and how would that process work? I have no clue about how that would happen. But I do think that all the options should be on the table on behalf of, you know, take off any of the politics and all that stuff. At the end of the day, it's all about the people who are living in this community who deserve to be in a community that's sustainable. Deserve to be in a place where they feel like their families can thrive. If that is not Highland Park, then we need to be saying, what are we doing here?
Alexis, I want to ask you, you spent a lot of time working with Mayor Duggan over the years. Do you think he ever runs for governor? I mean, that's always got to be the perennial question that he faces. But do you think he ever will?
I think that the mayor has, he's done an outstanding job in terms of when you think about Detroit, right? And, you know, I started administration in 2014, February of 2014. And at that time, I was just a news reporter covering the city of Detroit like everybody else, and had the opportunity to join administration to help really look at how we communicate. And at the time, then I went inside and realized all the different things that, we were up against. And when you look at what he's been able to do from taking tremendous challenges and creating opportunities that have actually benefited people, I think it's that work has been absolutely extraordinary. And I think there are lots of people who always ask him whether he wants to be governor or run for governor, and a lot of people who want him to do that. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to be up to him. And I have learned over my years of working with Mayor Duggan in a lot of different capacities, not to step in front of that, not to make any assumptions about what he's going to do. And I think he'll make a decision when it's the right time. But there are a lot of people I've heard more and more who are, you know, really think that kind of leadership could be great for the state overall. So not sure.
So you've obviously had experience working for Mayor Duggan. Tell us what that was like, how you came in from being a news reporter and then you become the chief of staff, and not just chief of staff. You're there for 6 years. I mean, given the workload that we hear, I mean, that's pretty remarkable. So kind of lead us through that.
Yeah, no, it was kind of crazy, but it was an amazing experience. I was a news reporter, and I had been in Detroit since 2010 and was working at Fox 2, loved Fox 2, really enjoyed my job. And I covered the mayor's race. I didn't know Mike Duggan. I didn't know Benny Napoleon. I didn't know anybody in it. And I just covered it. And I had no clue that one day in January, I'd be sitting at my desk. And I literally, I get a call and it's like, hey, this is Mike Duggan. And I kind of thought it was a prank, honestly. I was like, who is this? Mike Duggan just got my cell phone number and called. It's like, what? And long story short, he was like, oh, let's go to lunch. And we went to lunch. And at the time, I thought, oh, he's got a story for me. He's going to give me, I am such a great reporter. The new mayor is calling me for a story.
Right.
And I get there, and he's like, you know, would you want to join the administration and be the voice of our administration and help us communicate with people and engage people in an effective way? And at the time, I thought it was the craziest thing in the world. I was loving Fox 2, loved my job. But at the same time, I felt like when I moved to Detroit that I'd been really embraced by the community. And I was like, if I had an opportunity to actually serve and do some good, and then also see what it's like from not just covering it, but actually making some of those decisions and getting that view that it's weird. In a lot of ways, I still think of myself in a way like a reporter. I spent so long as a reporter, you still kind of think that way a little bit. And at the time, I was really excited for the opportunity to see how the sausage is made, right? And not just talk about how it should be made. See if you could actually. So I joined, and I was in the communications division, and I started, you know, the mayor would send me out to things and I'd be like, well, you know, yeah, we could say this, but I actually think we could be doing that, or we could do this. And I had no clue that I was actually kind of stepping out of the bounds of what I should have been doing as a spokesperson and moving more into that kind of telling people what needed to be done. And I was kind of ruffling some feathers. And at one point he said, okay, I need to give you a job where it's actually okay for you to go in and say, do this, do that, blah, blah, blah. And 3 months after starting, I became chief of staff.
Wow.
And just worked in the administration and got a chance to really be part and see how some of the great things that have been done were done, right? Knowing that there's still a lot of work to do. So I want to, whenever I talk about the great things that have been done or happening, that's right. You also have to acknowledge that there's still a long way to go, but I think that work is happening, and it's been really, it was cool to have it, to be a part of it.
I'm curious what he's like to work for, because I've watched a lot of his presentations, which he seems very impassioned and intense. Is he that way all the time?
Yeah, no, he's very passionate and intense about the work. The funny thing was I felt like when I was chief of staff, I worked long hours, but what made you feel better was that he worked longer hours at night. I mean, he constantly worked. And he still does, constantly focused on what he can do on behalf of the city. And one thing that always got to me was that, like, sometimes when we'd have conversations and we would get way too wonky and way too focused on, like, all the details and minutiae and all that stuff, he'd kind of bring us back to thinking about, okay, what we need to do is look at this from the lens of a person who lives in our city, lens of a child who is riding in through their neighborhood. What are they seeing? What are they experiencing? And really keeping the team rooted in why we're doing the work, which was on behalf of people, the community that we were serving, to deliver the best we could for them. And that was always really refreshing when you'd have those moments with him. I feel like I had him quite often. And he's just really, really focused on people and what we can do to make that day-to-day life of the average person better.
I want to combine the two conversations real quick. But, like, so if you were still chief of staff, what advice would you give Doug N when it comes to this question of Detroit absorbing Highland Park?
Man, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of, one thing that I did learn, right? Because I would potentially make a decision that would be based just on, like, my own passion or feeling, but there would have to be a lot of assessment done, right? Like, what are the real numbers? What would this do to the city? How would it impact our resources when it comes to things like policing? How do you manage their pension liabilities? Because they have pensioners. There are a lot of questions. Like, I think this is actually something that will take a long time to figure out, even if we go down a pathway, whether it's Hamtramck, whether it's Detroit. There's so many numbers. There's so much analysis that would need to be done to determine what would make sense. Because at the end of the day, you know, the mayor is going to have to make sure that whatever he does is in the best interest of Detroiters, right? Those current Detroiters. So how do you answer those questions? And I think you would see some very deep analysis. But at the end of the day, it does seem like, I think it's a viable question. I'd want to know what people in Highland Park think about that, right? What would they think about being, you know, becoming more, moving into a different community? I don't know. And I do think regardless, they need to be front and center. Like, nothing should be forced on anyone. And I think that they should be front and center on the solution, right? But I think at the end of the day, we all got to be honest that there is a problem. That's where you start. And that we do need a long-term solution, and that anything we do in this instance is going to be a band-aid. It's not going to solve it. And all we've seen, like, if we've learned anything from Detroit, you think about all the years, right? There were all these band-aids, right? And you eventually had to get to a real solution. And I think that's kind of where Highland Park would be. I know I'm not, I don't know everything, but that's my thought.
It kind of sounds like you're suggesting, I mean, especially when you mentioned the pension thing, the state's already stepped up in terms of the water debt issue with Island Park, but the state might have to play as large a role as it did in Detroit in order to get Hamtramck and Detroit to come to the plate to say we were willing to deal with this issue, right? Does that make sense? Is there a larger role the state is going to have to play?
You know, I can't answer that because I don't know enough of the minute details, but I do know that there needs to be an assessment of the big picture of it, right? And all the details, all the financial details, all of the risks, all the assets, all of that kind of stuff needs to be looked at. I mean, it doesn't seem like this is the first, I don't think this is the first time we're gonna run into this kind of situation. So why not think about the long-term solution?
You know, I also want to shift the conversation a bit on gun reform. Obviously, the red flag legislation setting up a petition process with the courts for temporary gun removal, that's on its way to the governor's desk. How do you imagine red flag being implemented and utilized in the city of Detroit?
You know, I think one thing to me, I mean, I think red flag laws, like gun violence, gun safety impacts all of us, right? One thing that's been interesting to me is I don't think it makes sense to treat Detroit and urban communities as separate from this gun safety conversation, because we are living these kind of issues every single day, right? It impacts your community. It impacts your safety. So I think that they'll have a positive impact, right? I mean, even efforts to try to, you know, make sure that you crack down on, like, straw sales and, you know, other things that if any effort that keeps guns or takes more guns off the street is good for all of us. And I think is universally good for all of us, in my opinion.
Yeah, but you think about Chicago, you know, that there has been some criticism that that city didn't utilize red flag enough and that there was very few petitions, you know, because, again, Detroit is the state's most populous city. Is there a concern of residents not being educated enough, not having the opportunity to utilize it?
No, you know, I think one thing that I found, you know, covering Detroit and then working in city government, I believe that we have a very, very informed electorate, an informed community, especially when it comes to issues that impact day-to-day life. You think about our block clubs, you think about the fact that we have a growing number of people who are participating in citizen block patrols, right? Where they're taking control of their public safety, playing an active role. And you think even from the mayor, I mean, if there's something that people in Detroit can do to take more guns off the streets, he's gonna make sure that people are educated on it. City council as well, right? I think that, and our state reps, I think there's not a question of whether people be educated on the tools and how to utilize the laws to make our streets safer.
All right. Well, it looks like we're going to have to end it right there. We appreciate your time today, Alexis Wiley, former chief of staff of Mayor Mike Duggan and now the CEO of Moment Strategies. She is also the chief strategist there. Appreciate you spending some time with us here, Alexis.
Thanks for inviting me, and thanks for the great conversation. You had all the tough questions on deck for me. So.
We were ready to go, but we knew you could handle each and every one, and you didn't disappoint. Thank you much.
Thank you. Bye. The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I need fun.
Join us now on the podcast is the ranking Republican on the House Appropriations Committee. It is Representative Sarah Leitner. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks, Kyle. Thanks for having me today.
So
it's always good to talk about what's going on, you know.
Well, the budget's what's going on. We've got subcommittees flying fast and furious, and we're diving into the budgets. And one thing that we've noticed is that there has not been a single Republican to vote yes on any of the bills coming out of subcommittee. Is that a concentrated, conscious effort?
Well, you know, there's a couple of reasons behind it. Yes. I mean, there is an effort, obviously. You know, we want to actually know what's in the bills, right? And I can tell you yesterday, you know, I'll give you a good example. Yesterday, we had transportation subcommittee. And you know, I don't see transportation, but as you know, as the ranking Republican, you know, I'm responsible to work with our chairs, our minority chairs, and go through the bills and go through possible amendments. And I can tell you, I still didn't have the bill when session got over yesterday. And that committee was supposed to meet and vote on it, which they did, but we didn't have the bill.
But
other issue is, you know, May crack isn't until May 19th. And so, you know, we want solid numbers, right, to have a, you know, fiscally responsible budget. And I think that it's just not good governance to spend money. We're not 100% sure we know we're going to have yet. And I will say, though, you know, some of the budgets have come in under what I anticipated. And some are under the executive rec, which is, I think, movement in the right direction, especially anticipating revenues being down a little bit.
How much have the Republicans been involved in the crafting of these initial budget bills?
Well, you know, we've had conversations. Some of the chairs have done, I would say, have done a pretty good job with some oversight. In particular, you know, DHHS is a huge budget, right? And I know that Representative Morse has done a great job holding numerous oversight committee hearings and having frank discussions with her members. I will say there were some things in there that I was pleasantly surprised with, you know, as far as reporting and transparency requirements. But I will tell you that my chairs with some of them have been good. Some really haven't. They're like, you know, they haven't really involved me in the process, which, as you know, is nothing new. Mm-hmm. It, you know, it works both ways. It's funny how the tide has turned a little bit, right? But, you know, I continue to have conversations with Representative Whitwer. You know, we did have a good relationship going into this term. As you know, we shared Eaton County for 4 years. So that helps with some of the trust and just knowing each other and knowing how each other works and what's kind of important for our caucuses, because it's not what I want. It's what, you know, my caucus would like to see in some of the budgets. It's also what's best for the people of Michigan in, you know, trying to be fiscally responsible also in these budgets. So, you know, not having the time before the vote is one of the things that kind of hindered, obviously, any yes votes.
Danny?
Of course, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, when looking at a lot of the bills that were voted out of appropriations this last week, not the subcommittee, but just the general committee, one of the few bills that I saw got, you know, widespread bipartisan support was Rep. Andrews's bill for the DNR. I believe it's the trust fund. And, you know, that one, it seemed like there was a lot more agreement on things. That process went a little bit faster. So what is happening differently?
Oh, the difference with that is that's something that was actually determined last year. And so, you know, when you sine die and you end a legislative session, all the bills die. So you have to refile them. Well, obviously now they are in majority, the Democrats. So a Democrat is the lead on that. And so all those projects were already approved and went through the process last year. That's why there was a lot of support there, because it's something we were going to do at the end of last year. Or, well, it was ready last year. So that's the reason that got support.
So is the one of the issues here with these budgets for 2024 is that the Republicans want to make sure you got maximum leverage for when you actually go and negotiate what you really want. So you're not on record having supported something that then you got to go back and try and get things later when you've already supported them in the first place.
Right. And, you know, this is all just part of the process. This is the first big step in the appropriations process every year. So it's nothing new. We have these same conversations every year. I think probably the same comments every year. You know, whoever's in minority, we complain, you know, now it's us. So we're complaining about the timeline. You know, you don't want to have those situations where you have a bill out there and just vote for it to see what's in it. We don't think that way. We actually read them and analyze them and try to go through the line items, do our due diligence, and make sure, you know, the money that's being spent is responsible. You know what I mean? So this is something that happens every year, but this is just a good first step. I think when you have a pass, that puts you in a good position because, you know, like me, I pass on some budgets because there's some good stuff in some of them, you know, that I think's great for the state. It's beneficial. It supports programs or institutions, education, transportation, you know, there's road stuff. But there's always stuff we don't like, right? It doesn't matter who's in power. And, you know, I chose to pass because I don't want to be on record at this point saying absolutely not on some things that are good. You know, you can always find good and bad in all the budgets, no matter what. But I think, you know, Rep. Whitwer and I are just trying to do the best we can with our caucuses. You know, obviously I represent the Republican caucus and, you know, each of us represent around 90,000 people. And we're just trying to go through everything and do the best we can as far as like looking at boilerplate language, even because, you know, that is where you put guardrails on certain programs or appropriate certain dollars, ask for reporting, transparency. Plus, we, you know, want to make sure some of the problems that we're addressing on the policy side are also going to be funded next year. Because, for instance, we have juvenile justice stuff coming up. I sat on the Juvenile Justice Task Force. I was appointed by Governor Whitmer to be one of the representatives from the House, was actively engaged in that process. I sat on numerous work groups for over a year. And last summer, we came out with a whole list of recommendations as a commission. That was supported by the governor, lieutenant governor, and then multiple stakeholders throughout the state. Well, we already have those bills ready, and we know that they're likely going to get across the finish line. Well, some of them are going to need additional money to be implemented, you know, in the state or the county, in the courts, juvenile detention centers, residential centers, all of that. And so, you know, as we're going through this budget process, we're also keeping those things in mind, because that's something that we need to invest in as the policy comes up and some changes in law happen.
Right.
Well, now right now that's bipartisan and bicameral.
All right. So one more thing here on the budget here before we switch gears. Three things that you want out of this budget. What are three things that the House Republicans want out of this budget?
Well, one is transportation dollars, local dollars, not just MDOT dollars. We have a lot of local municipalities, townships, counties that have take care of the secondary roads, the roads we drive going, you know, here to there, my house to the school, right, stuff like that. So we want to make sure we prioritize that, because that was a promise by the governor for years. And we just want to make sure that that actually happens. There's also reporting and transparency stuff that's in there that needs to stay in there. People already have a problem with the government, not trusting them, not trusting what they're doing with the money, you know, things like that. And we've made some good headway, I would say, in the foreign tax policy, obviously with the earned income tax credit, the pension tax, and then preserving the rollback to 4.05. So people get to keep more of their paycheck.
Do you foresee some Republicans voting for the final product?
I would think so. I would like to say yes. It's my intent to do the best I can inserting our priorities into the budget as well, working with Representative Whitwer and the admin in regards to these things, because I think we need to do more of the putting the people over the politics. And just say, okay, is this something that's appropriate for the whole state? You know, there's always pet projects in every single budget, but I would like to see more of that money used to, one, give back to the people, and two, fund priorities around the state. You know, I talked about transportation, also like broadband's still a big issue, especially in the days of now post-COVID, but still using all the online technology and so hopefully, you know, things like that get across the finish line.
We've heard a lot of different, you know, timelines and estimates in terms of how long this is going to take. When do you think we'll start to see something close to a finished product?
I would say in the next couple of weeks. I mean, next week we will finish voting out the rest of the budgets. We'll discharge them to the floor from appropriations. And then, you know, that's where more robust conversations happen. As you know, Rep. Whitwer has already filed the omnibus bill. So likely all these will be put into an omnibus. And then after the May crack, that's when we'll have the real dollars, I think, you know, that we know are going to be available. At that point, we're going to have a good estimate of, you know, how much money we kind of have to, I guess, play around with, you know, because we have other developing issues. You know, we have a childcare issue right now. There's some disparities there with childcare and the federal grants and state grants that people are supposed to be getting. But there's a lack of communication there. So hopefully we can get things like that taken care of so people don't have to worry too much about that while they're working.
Representative, you represent the city of Marshall, correct?
Correct.
All right. So on this past week, and we're recording Friday for the Monday edition here, but this past week, the city of Marshall and the Marshall Township Joint Planning Commission voted 4-2 against recommending rezoning a piece of property designed to be part of the proposed Ford battery plant that Governor Whitmer negotiated in Marshall earlier this term. What is the concern in Marshall about this plant?
Sure. Well, there's quite a few, obviously. I came into the district in January as the new representative, right? Having Marshall now in Emmett Township and all that surrounding area, actually. And I have heard from numerous, I can't even tell you right now, numerous people. I've been there. I talked to the MEDA people. I had meetings. I actually drove to the site, all of that, you know, the proposed site. The issue we have is, one, there was a transparency issue, right? When they were negotiating the whole deal, the residents of Marshall really didn't even know what was going on. They're like, I don't know what it's going to be, because they didn't know yet. They didn't know if it was going to be solar, if it was going to be this EV, whatever. And so, you know, and I get it, because they're negotiating, you know, timelines, properties, all that, all those things. And other entities might be negotiating for, you know, projects also. And so, you know, maybe sometimes you need to stay a little tight lip for some of the finer details, because that's just a part of the process. But when you don't, when you're not super transparent with people that live there and that know the area, it's scary. And a lot of times when things are scary, people are like, no, I don't want it. And so that's a lot of it. But generally people are just concerned with the farmland. I also am a farmer, and we don't make new land every day, right? And so this proposed site is around 1800 acres total, but the amount that was in question, I think, is about 700 and something. Yes. I don't have it in front of me. It was 731 or something like that.
Yeah. 741. Yep.
41. Anyway, you know, right now it's zoned ag, and I can see where people want to keep it that way, you know, ag preservation people, just people around there in general. You do get into some personal property rights issues, I think, but, you know, when you tell people what they can and cannot do with their land. But, you know, generally this Ford project hasn't went over super well with just the everyday resident, okay? Some of the people that have been involved, some of the people that are part of the economic development, some of the other small businesses, they're all for it. But there's been a lot of concern around the whole project. One, we probably prayed, well, there's no probably. I think personally that we paid a premium to keep Ford here. You know, I've sat on appropriations. This is my fifth year. And, you know, we did some SOAR projects. We've done economic development in the past. So we're not against economic development. The problem is when you're talking taxpayer dollars, and return on investment, this one has the worst ROI of any project we've ever put forward.
That's not hyperbole either.
No, that's accurate. And those reports have been posted. I think the ROI on this, once it's done and finished, is only like a 1.2 on a scale of 1 to 10. Okay. So when you talk about, well, you voted for the battery plant in Delta Township. Yeah, well, the ROI on that was like 7 point something out of 10. You know, they have a lot more investment, a lot more skin in the game. And then when you add in all the federal tax dollars that are going to go into this, I mean, you're looking at almost $3 billion of taxpayer funds total between the state and the feds. And then Ford's putting in $3 billion themselves. So the taxpayers are paying for half of it. And then, you know, there's also at the township level, there's a $772 million tax abatement for the Renaissance, you know, area for 15 years. So, you know, there's a lot of money invested in this to keep Ford here. I applaud them. I hope I'm wrong. That's all I can say is I hope I'm wrong on the project, because as you know, I voted against it. Because that's what I heard. I had an overwhelming number of constituents call me. I also had personal documents, you know, once like February got here, and I just couldn't in my heart vote for something like this using the taxpayer dollars when people are still struggling. And there was the whole contention with the tax rollback. And, you know, when it's only going to affect one little region of the state. And when we're talking about a tax rollback that would affect all working people of Michigan and anyone that files an income tax, we're only talking $800 million to give them relief a year. And yet you give up $1.78 billion to one project in one part of the state. I just didn't see equity in that. So I just couldn't, I just, at the end of the day, could not get to a yes.
I know there's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of concern within the legislature that this company that Ford is working with, CATL, has Chinese origins. Is that something that you've heard concern from constituents of Marshall as well?
Oh, yeah. And as you know, that's also a concern with the Goshen project, you know. There is a serious concern because, you know, there's national security issues around that. And, you know, at one of the hearings, they claimed that, you know, the Chinese people were one of two people in the world that produced that type of technology and that have the know-how to teach us how to do it. Well, then a couple of weeks later, we have this other battery plant people come in, organization, and they're a United States company that has the technology and the research and the backing, and we have the resources here. So that was also another concern. And it's a huge concern with my caucus. I didn't get into the finer details of the Chinese stuff, but, you know, you're seeing that now with Goshen, the Goshen project, and, you know, the direct correlation to the Chinese Communist Party. So yeah, it's a huge concern for lots of my constituents.
If the city of Marshall turns this down, is the project dead? Do you have any insight on that?
Well, they still own quite a bit of land already under MEDA and under agreements ahead of time. I don't know. This is a new development with them not approving it, so I'm not sure yet. I have to do some more research and double check that. You know, it might be one of those things they have to scale back. But if they have to scale back, that means they're not going to hit certain metrics, which means part of those clawbacks will come back. So they won't receive some of this money. So, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it works. I don't know yet. I have to have that conversation.
Representative Sarah Leitner, who is the ranking House Republican on the Appropriations Committee. Appreciate you joining us here on the podcast.
Thanks, Kyle. So many times betrayed, trying to find an honest word to
fight the truth enslaved. Oh. Joining us now on the podcast is State Representative Noah Arbit, Democrat from West Bloomfield, who had a very active week this week introducing a couple of packages we're going to talk about now. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Representative.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
You've put on the table some tougher penalties for hate crimes here in the state. Where is your interest coming from on this particular issue?
Well, I'm not sure I would, you know, necessarily frame it as tougher penalties. I would say we are strengthening Michigan's hate crime laws. The Ethnic Intimidation Act, which is our current hate crime law, hasn't been amended in 35 years, even once since its passage, which was 7 years before I was born. When I was campaigning, this was the top issue that I campaigned on, part of the Jewish and LGBTQ plus communities. And so this is very personal to me, as it is for my fellow sponsors on the package, Representative Grant of Grand Rapids and Representative Puri of Canton. We represent the communities that are, you know, most targeted by hate crimes and rising hate crimes in the state of Michigan and across the country, and most invested in making sure that our laws are worth the paper they're written on. And so these bills, the Michigan Hate Crime Act and the Institutional Desecration Act, which I've been working on, you know, pretty much even since before I took office, will really go a long way to making sure that Michigan is going from national laggard to national leader on hate crime prevention, intervention, and response. During my campaign, I promised my community in the greater West Bloomfield area that I would move heaven and earth to do just that. And I'm very proud to start delivering on that promise, which is so meaningful to me. I think it's also really interesting that in this work, we discovered that the original sponsor of the Ethnic Intimidation Act was a Republican from West Bloomfield. And of course, then State Representative Lisa Brown, Democrat from West Bloomfield, had introduced a bill that wasn't heard, didn't even make it to committee on amending the law. So, you know, I'm sort of falling in a legacy of legislators from my community, you know, working to combat hate and hate violence. And that's very meaningful to me.
You know, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's in these two packages and how you believe this will help strengthen Michigan's hate crime law?
Yeah, so the Michigan Hate Crime Act overhauls the Ethnic Intimidation Act. First of all, we get rid of the antiquated language, ethnic intimidation. As the Attorney General mentioned during our press conference on Wednesday, no one really knows what that means. Actually, the Ethnic Intimidation Act currently doesn't even mention ethnicity. So it just goes to show you how shoddily the law was written in 1988. You know, we expand the categories in which hate crimes can be targeted to include sexual orientation and gender identity and expression, as well as physical and mental disability, age, and ethnicity. So those we're adding, you know, to race, religion, national origin, et cetera. We also add an aggravated felony. So the main penalty remains the same, but for aggravating factors such as, you know, are you targeting a minor? Do you have a firearm in the commission of a crime? Are you committing this in concert with other individuals? So is it like gang violence or militia violence or in some concerted way like that? Also, you know, is this, you know, your second conviction? You know, so are you, you know, a habitual offender of this? And then, of course, it adds some really important language around like mistaken identity. Like we've seen a number of cases where hate crimes are targeted against people for an assumed identity that is not accurate. So really, this is just bringing up Michigan and best practice that we have failed to achieve. You know, in the intervening 35 years, Michigan has seen a rise of hate violence and no corresponding legislative action. Meanwhile, other states have instituted best practices. So we're really making sure that Michigan is going to be a national leader in this issue. And also we have some alternative sentencing, restorative justice. We're, you know, starting the conversation on that in certain circumstances. And then the institutional desecration piece is specifically carving out in Michigan law that it is a hate crime to target houses of worship, other communal or cultural centers and communal property. We're talking about a Black-owned business, a gay bar, and sort of these crimes right now are charged under malicious destruction of property. But it's really, you know, there's some deficiencies with that approach. And so making sure that we have improved tools to combat hate violence and to, you know, pursue justice and accountability. That's the point of the Institutional Desecration Act, which I'm proud to work with Representative Ranjiv Puri on.
Where do you feel like we are as far as these types of crimes, hate crimes, compared to maybe years past? You know, I don't know how much research you've done on it, but going back maybe 20, 30, 10, 5 years, where are we right now as far as the groups that seem to be targeted and what kind of language and acts are being done against these particular groups of people?
Well, we've done a ton of research. The issue is that we know that only about between 2 and 10% of hate crimes are reported. So the data is really tough, but, you know, by the metrics that we have, you know, we're at an all-time high. Really? And that's, you know, pretty consistent. Yep. It's pretty consistent across the country. But Michigan is one of the, you know, states with actually the highest incidence of hate crimes, particularly, you know, the Black community is targeted, you know, first and foremost, you know, more than any, but, you know, rise in hate crimes targeting LGBT people. Of course, that's not protected in Michigan law right now, which is really important. Rising crimes against people with disabilities, also rise against, you know, anti-Semitic hate crimes. And, you know, obviously that's really important to me representing, you know, the most Jewish district in the state. That's a big part of, you know, how I come to this. The Pittsburgh synagogue shooting and, you know, the Orlando shootings just, you know, really had, you know, a profound impact on me. And sort of, you know, then I started the Michigan Democratic Jewish Caucus where I tracked anti-Semitism. And, you know, so this is all part and parcel of like, you know, where I come from and the community that I come from and making sure that we are, you know, really rising against hate. And I think the other thing that I want to clarify, too, is that this does not criminalize speech. The Supreme Court has ruled time and time again that hate crime laws are constitutional and do not abridge the First Amendment. We're talking about actions, right? You do not have a constitutional right to target people for violence based on their identity or what community they belong to. And unfortunately, it's an all too common occurrence. I think it's really important because I know people will have questions, you know, why don't we treat hate crimes like all other crimes? They're just like other crimes, but they're not. They are terroristic in nature. The reason why we treat them differently is because they are terroristic in nature. There's never just one victim of a hate crime. There's always an entire community that is victimized too, because when someone is targeted because they're Muslim and there's a hate crime against someone who's Muslim, the entire Muslim community is said, you know, is being told, you don't belong here, you are not welcome here, and you will not be safe here. And so that's why it's important that we actually have laws that are worth the paper they're written on as a deterrent as well.
You spent a lot of time, I'm assuming, working with Attorney General Dana Nessel on this bill package, and she was present at the press conference. So how did you, you know, what was that process like working with her and deciding on these penalties? And, you know, could you tell us a little bit about what the penalties are under your bill package?
Yeah, and I think it's really important because, you know, I come to this as a, you know, a passionate advocate against hate crimes and hate violence. And of course, I am not an attorney. I worked at the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office where, you know, I got a little bit of a taste of how hard these cases are to charge. You know, the threshold to proving a crime of bias in court is so substantial. It's one of the only crimes. You know, usually, you know, someone, you know, a prosecutor, you know, you prove intent in court in order to prove that a crime occurred and that this individual did it. Right. This is one of the crimes that you actually have to prove intent in order to get the conviction. Right. And of course, we have a mixed motivations statute in Michigan, which is the strongest part of our law because it's in whole or in part. You know, it doesn't, you know, necessarily the threshold isn't that, you know, that this crime was committed solely because of, you know, the bias. Right. It only has to be a factor. And that's a really strong part of the law that actually is best practice developed here in Michigan that other states have incorporated as well. But, you know, like I said, we have, you know, a 2-year felony that is, you know, maintained consistent with the 1988 law in the Michigan Hate Crime Act, and then a 5-year aggravated penalty, which, you know, we thought is important to recognize that there are some that are specifically very uniquely egregious types of crimes and that they should, you know, be, you know, and I think part of it is like the calculation with a prosecutor, right? Because the threshold is very high to proving these crimes and the resources devoted to such a case are pretty substantial. If the penalties are too weak, you're going to get a prosecutor choosing to go on a lower charge to, you know, get the conviction. But I've always believed that, you know, part of the issue here is that we need to understand what's going on in our communities. And if you're just charged with battery and assault, or assault or battery, and you actually were targeting someone because of, you know, their, you know, racial identity or their religious affiliation, and it's not, you know, reported as a hate crime because it's not charged as a hate crime, it obscures our full understanding of what's happening in our communities. And that leaves us, you know, somewhat blind. And so we want this hate crime act, the Michigan Hate Crime Act, to be a more useful tool than the Ethnic Intimidation Act was, to be able to, you know, to get us to understand what's going on in our communities.
Let's change subjects here. The next day, you were at the press conference to expand the statute of limitations on sexual assault cases. That has not been successful in getting to the governor under prior legislatures because there's always been this pushback about that there's going to be some old 20, 25-year-old incident that's going to pop up, expose somebody or some group or somebody of note to some type of liability, and then the insurance is going to have to kick in and dump a bunch of money into a case that is so old, maybe people don't remember it, reputations get tarnished. That's always been the pushback. How do you get through that headwind this term, where in prior terms it wasn't successful?
Well, first of all, I'll say I'm very grateful for the just tireless and persistent leadership of Representative Julie Brixey, who has been leading this fight for a long time, as well as Representative Reggie Miller, who, like myself, is a freshman from Van Buren Township, but came in, you know, really ready to tackle this issue. And, you know, I would just say that, you know, I don't have a lot of sympathy for those arguments. You know, I am someone who, you know, I speak not just as a state representative, but also as a survivor myself. And, you know, really, you know, someone who has, you know, I took action through the criminal justice system, you know, immediately. But I understand that that's not always everyone's first inclination. And there are lots of reasons why people choose not to go down that path. And there are also lots of reasons why they, you know, at a later date would want to. And I think that the way that this crime manifests and, you know, has an impact on people personally, you know, psychologically, it's really important that we give space for the fact that justice can often take a long time to be able to be pursued, you know. So I think that this legislation is vital and could not be more important. And, you know, I'll work with Representative Brixey, Representative Miller, and the rest of the, you know, sponsors on the package to make sure that we are moving heaven and earth to make sure it's passed, because, you know, Michigan needs to be a state that's leading on this. And so far we haven't, you know. What was stuck out to me yesterday during the press conference, which I just could not wrap my head around, was, you know, this was Michigan is home to two of the largest sexual assault cases in the history of this country. And it's abysmal. It is abysmal. So, I don't have a lot of sympathy for that. And it's time we get this legislation across the finish line.
Yeah, you definitely had a very busy week this week. and that's awesome. But I was wondering, not being able to attend that Friday press conference, could you tell me a little bit about, the package and then also what your bill specifically deals with?
Yeah. So, my bill is more of a, sort of technical, fix, with particular attention to, state government claims made against, state government officers within the state government, with related to the statute of limitations. Right. This package, is about, justice for survivors, making sure that the statute of limitations, civilly is not an impediment to receiving the justice that survivors, should a court, reify that decision, are due, right? This is a package that has been worked on, for consecutive legislative sessions, and so has gone through improvements. And I know that Representative Brixey has worked with, the AG's office as well. And I always say to, my colleagues, I would always recommend working with the AG's office. Making sure that things are constitutional is a big part of our jobs here. But it's really important that we are. I think Michigan's laws right now, as it pertains to, access to justice for sexual assault, are pretty weak. And there's a number of other states who have, made these changes. And it's really time that we do as well, particularly because, we've had the Nassar and Anderson cases.
Kind of changing focus here. It does seem like the big focus on the House side right now on the floor is making sure that you get budgets through. As far as spending priorities, what do you want to make sure gets into the budget?
So I've been, a pretty relentless, voice on mental health and making sure that we have, funding for mental health. I know Chairwoman Christine Morse has worked really hard to make sure that we have a DHHS budget that reflects the crisis in mental health in Michigan, particularly among our youth. I always talk, kids, seniors, and everyone in between, right? And making sure that, we are just, sort of channeling resources where the greatest need is. And so I'm very passionate about that. And I'm very confident that, of course I don't serve on appropriations committees, but I'm very confident that our budget will reflect the needs of Michiganders.
One of the things that the governor has been insistent on early in the session is to get economic incentive money out, whether it's to Ford for their Marshall plant or to Goshen. How much appetite do you feel is in your caucus to continue down the road of more economic incentives when a lot of the priorities that y'all ran on really haven't been addressed as acutely as those economic development pieces?
Well, I think we always have to look at, budgetary constraints. And I think these sort of super site and mega site projects, from my perspective, may not deliver, the greatest, benefit, cost benefit in terms of, when you sort of look at, what is the broadest base, benefit that could be, given to the people of Michigan. So I think what we're trying to look at is, whether some smaller projects, mid-sized projects, mid-sized sites, across the state and not just, one giant site, whether that might not be a better sort of direction for us to go in. And I think there are ongoing conversations both in the House and the Senate. But, I think, as it stands, that's sort of the direction that we're looking in, if we're going to do any more of those, sort of targeted economic development projects, I think that's where the appetite will be is some of those more smaller projects that are perhaps a better bang for your buck.
Is there anything that immediately comes to mind when you think of some of these smaller economic incentive packages?
Well, I tend to think about, places like, I represent West Bloomfield, which borders Pontiac, and I think about, what kind of transformational investment that some of these municipalities, could benefit from. And, just even smaller, whether it's grants or, incentives in a community like that, right? Which is, you know, right next to me. And so I think about, you know, I think it's just sort of I think it's just, you know, when you're channeling so much towards one place, right? How does that broadly benefit everyone? And I think that's the questions that I think everyone is asking. Of course, you know, I'm no expert on this, but I'm trying to understand, right? If I'm looking at, wanting every community to thrive in this state, whether it might not be better to have, you know, smaller incentives to smaller targeted areas, you know, so everyone can get a little bit better instead of, you know, one community that's, you know, receiving, you know, just a massive infusion. And, you know, and if you look at Marshall, and I know there's some sort of controversy and dissent over, you know, whether this is, you know, the best direction for the community, it's going to irrevocably transform their community, change their community. And, you know, for some of the residents, that's a good thing. And for some of the residents, they don't agree. So I think, you know, it's certainly something that communities have to think about, whether or not that's the direction they want to go in. But I think smaller investments, you know, to a wider swath of communities and wider swath of projects might be a better direction to go in the future.
Well, we're going to have to leave it right there. Representative Noah Arbit, Democrat from West Bloomfield, appreciate you being on our podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to all of our guests today, Alexis Wiley, Representative Sarah Leitner, and Representative Noah Arbit. Also like to thank AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. For the boss, John Rarick, and Samantha Shriver, I'm Kyle Malin. Until next week, take care.